Hi, I'm Brianna Contreras, Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Hello, I'm Peter Werwein. I'm Senior Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Welcome to MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access, a new podcast series part of our Tuning into the C-Suite podcast from Managed Healthcare Executive.
Patient access is a challenge that everyone in healthcare seems to have been talking about for decades. It's one of those big tent problems of American healthcare, a topic that takes in everything from practical problems like transportation to a doctor's appointment, or maybe in today's telehealth era, spotty Wi-Fi. There are also financial barriers to access, such as high out-of-pocket costs, and structural barriers, such as deeply rooted healthcare disparities and racism.
Our new podcast, MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access, will feature healthcare leaders and executives who are working to pull down the barriers to patient access. The goal is to have a lively, informative conversation about a foundational issue in American healthcare.
Well, hello, everybody. My name is Peter Werwein, and I am Senior Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. And today, I'm talking to Vajang Mwa, or Mwa. I've butchered your last name, I'm afraid. And he has an interesting job, a job that I think more positions like this are being created, or certainly they should be. He's director of racial and health equity advocacy at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. So good afternoon.
It's good to be here, Peter. Thank you.
And just do me a favor. How do you pronounce your last name?
Yeah. It's funny because usually people have more challenges with my first name, but it's Vajang Mua. Yeah. Vajang.
Very good.
Thank you for asking. Yeah.
So could you just begin by telling us a little bit about your position at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota and a little bit about your background and how you came to work for a health insurance company, which I'm sure was not your goal in life when you were 10 or 11.
Well, maybe I can respond in reverse order here, Peter. I came to this country as a infant, as a Hmong refugee, and my family was the first Hmong family in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, just across the river. And you're right, I never imagined myself in this position or this role. You know, and growing up, actually, at the age of about 15, I was really fascinated with philosophy, actually. And I knew that I wanted to major in that. And when I told my parents that, you can imagine their response, you know, was like, we didn't cross the Mekong River for you to think deeply about being unemployed. You know, they wanted me to be a doctor, an engineer, or something tangible and with prestige, not a racial and health equity advocacy director. But little did they know that it really was kind of because of them that I'm in this role. My mother worked in public health in the Eau Claire Public Health Department for 25 years. My father worked for City Hall for 25 years. And I am prompted and forged by both civic engagement and public health, I would say. And then I went on to study public policy at UW-Madison. And so the combination of philosophy, anthropology, and public policy set me up on this trajectory. I am the director of racial and health equity advocacy. And to unpackage that a little bit, at the heart of that, I would say, Peter, is to embed racial and health equity analysis, principles, and priorities into key decision-making processes. Certainly public policy, but also organizational budgets, strategic plans. We know that so much of what creates these inequities are in inequities in decision-making. And so I would call my work about that it's equity in governance and in key decision making. And then that obviously applies to key issue areas like commercial tobacco control, which is a huge part of my work, or food security issues, or the way we design our communities, transportation, land use, and chronic disease prevention. And obviously with COVID-19 too, and all the gross inequities we see there. So the best description I can offer you, Peter, is like, it's racial and health equity applied to key issue areas, that most notably preventable chronic disease from pandemic to epidemic. And then also upstream of that into how priorities become priorities. And so I want to highlight the advocacy too. Yeah.
But it sounds like it's your job at the company to maybe apply the lens of equity to policies, programs, decisions that Blue Cross Blue Shield makes. Maybe as a result of that lens, something gets adjusted so it reaches a racial or health equity goal that maybe it wouldn't have done otherwise. Is that it? So you're both are you kind of a lens and a filter as well as a proposer of doing this?
Yeah, I think that's a good capture, Peter. I would actually take it even a little bit farther. The lens and the analysis is baseline, right? I think we know that consideration needs to take action. It has to actually translate into how a budget is formulated, a staffing plan is formulated, how a bill is analyzed. And so I would say the consideration itself is just a starting point, and it requires advocacy. It requires, unfortunately, consistent, constant case making, and power. This is about power, influence, about determining priorities. And so the lens is, I would just say, the front end aspect of the work. Yeah.
Now, you could have assumed this role in many types of organizations, and I'm sure you've given some thought about how this plays out for an insurance company, a payer, which just in the public mindset are as much as maybe insurers try to be liked, mm-hmm. Just as a category, it's not something that the public naturally embraces as an agent of change.
Yeah.
Insurers tend to be in a position of saying no. So how does this sort of interdigitate with insurance?
Yeah. Well, earlier you asked about like how did I arrive here, right? And I was my CEO may be listening or hearing this, but I have no qualms saying that when I first applied to Blue Cross, I had great hesitation and skepticism. I came from American Cancer Society and working on education inequities with the school district in Minneapolis. But it was the fact that Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota sued the tobacco industry, and that our health plan along with the state of Minnesota were co-plaintiffs. And I began to really understand commercial tobacco control in the context of social justice. And so my role was actually brought on to pass local smoke-free ordinances. So in my first few weeks, Peter, I was dealing with tobacco lobbyists. I was doing community organizing, right? And this is like the public health issue of the time. And so I was drawn to the big fight with the tobacco industry. I was drawn to how the industry talked in very racist and disparaging terms about communities of color, about the Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and Asian American community. And that really ignited me to get in the fight. And so that's kind of how I got involved with Blue Cross. And I would also say, Peter, that the way my organization and the way I view these racial and health inequities is beyond healthcare. It certainly is healthcare, but we know from the science of social determinants of health, most of what creates health is upstream of that, right? And I feel that in this role, I have the opportunity to address inequities at the nexus, the convergence points of all these issues: housing, education, transportation, food security. And so because of that latitude and depth, I feel like I'm in position to actually deal with structural racial inequities and not just an important issue, but I'm always concerned about being segmented and focusing on a narrow aspect of the problem. So those are just some key drawing points for me. Yeah.
So you're in Minnesota, which I know a little bit about, having been raised there. It is one of the healthiest states by many metrics. I think the life expectancy of Minnesota is, in some counties, is the longest of any place in the country. Stearns County, I think, sticks in my brain. Yet I think you've done some research, or the organization does, or maybe it was you in partnership with some people at the University of Minnesota that have explored the issue of health equity in Minnesota, and revealing that there's kind of inconvenient truth that that actually there's some pretty serious inequity issues there. So could you discuss those findings? I'm doing this from memory, but according to, I think some stuff that was sent along prior to this discussion, it was a certain number of lives lost, and there was a financial component too.
Sure. I'm happy to give you a overview of that study. It's called The Costs of Health Inequities in Minnesota. But before kind of digging into that, Peter, I just want to acknowledge that, as you alluded to, Minnesota has this high peaks, low valleys phenomena when it comes to racial and health inequities. And on average, we are better than average, right? And again, if you look not only at health, but employment, graduation rates, home ownership, income, all the so-called indicators of a quality life and society, Minnesota ranks very consistently high if you're white, right? And so, you know, our study builds upon a mountain of evidence, not just our study in the last few years, 2018, but our own Department of Health in 2013 produced a groundbreaking report called Advancing Health Equity, where it called structural racism as a root cause of these health inequities. And so I just want to, as I highlight our own study, I want to honor the fact that we've known for a long, long time, and that there's been a lag in what we've known scientifically and what the public has understood and prioritized. And so I want to acknowledge that. So our study done in 2018 was in partnership with the University of Minnesota, the School of Medicine, and our School of Public Affairs, the Humphrey School of Public Policy. And what we uncovered was that health inequities, preventable health inequities, cost the state $2.26 billion, with a B, billion dollars per year. Okay. And this isn't even direct medical costs, Peter. This is costs in lost wages, lost time away from work, lost productivity. Mm-hmm. And what the study also revealed is that the American Indian community experiences diabetes and chronic liver disease at four times the rate of the general population. The Asian Pacific Islander community with in regard to diabetes and chronic liver disease experiences at 3 times the rate. Our African American community, 1.5 times the rate. Latinx community, 1.2 times. If you look at infant mortality, our African American community, 3 times the rate in infant mortality. You know, I talked about my origin in tobacco control. Our smoking prevalence rate in the American Indian community, Peter, in Minnesota, 59%.
Oh my gosh.
The average Minnesotan, 14%. Okay. So I usually try to stay away from the data because I think we've known that. We've never lost on the science. We've never lost on the truth, on data. But we've lost in not showing up at the hearing rooms, not showing up in policy making, not translating what we've known into systems change. So I don't know how many U.S. surgeon reports you've seen, Peter, on the harms of smoking, right? Through the generations, right? And the same thing is true for racial and health inequities. This data that shows these disparities, I use the term inequities because I want people to understand that this isn't just a numerical difference. These are preventable, avoidable, and unjust differences in health. And that's CDC, WHO definitions of health inequities.
So I guess I have a couple of questions, or actually many, but time is relatively short. So this is a 2018 report. I guess I'm curious what sort of, maybe just a mention of a couple things that have been done to address this, either by Blue Cross Blue Shield or some entity that the company's allied with. And do you see these these are two dissimilar questions, but do you see these inequity issues as being sort of, just sort of classic SDOH things, or are there access issues as well? I guess access issues can be SDOH too, but I'm just wondering how you, what do you think about the causes? You've referenced, tobacco, of course, which,
I think I'm grasping the essence of your question, Peter, kind of root causes here and how does it apply across the continuum of health, whether it's downstream in care and treatment and insurance and access. I think structural racism permeates the entire continuum. And I, even though we know that only 10% of what creates health occurs in, a physician's office or in a clinic setting, that doesn't mean it's not significant either. And so I think we have to understand that because of the social determinants of health, we see very clearly that health is about upstream decision-making, upstream conditions. And that tells me that these inequities are unnatural, right? That they're human created. And if you can trace, whether you're looking at food security, a SNAP utilization or smoking prevalence or diabetes or COVID-19, you can trace a lot of these inequities into policy-making bodies, into agenda setting. And so I've been using the term political determinants of health, and WHO is reframing this too. And I want to be clear, Peter, I don't mean partisan politics. I mean political in terms of power, financial resources, information, social and political capital. Okay, so it's because we know that these are not conditions that arose randomly, right? So I'll be clear in that.
So what does one do? this becomes a boulder. So what does one do in the here and now? And what does, what do you do, or what does Blue Cross Blue Shield, you know, it seems like one has to pick a lever or two, or else you just end up, you know, in a chat room.
Yeah, you're right. You know, and Peter, my experience across a multitude of issues, from tobacco to food security, transportation, I've arrived at this epiphany, if you will, which is the lever is in how we advocate and approach all of these issues. It's not in picking an issue over the other. I think we've been throwing programmatic solutions at a structural problem. You cannot have implicit bias trainings or a multicultural potluck or a anti-racism book club to solve this, right? I want to honor the importance of enlightenment, of education, but we've been waiting for over 400 years, Peter, on this racial equity consciousness, and that's not what we can rely on. And so I think in the name of policy change, we have to go after the impact of policies and systems, not necessarily even the enlightenment of it, right? So where I'm putting a lot of my energy, Peter, is in equity, integration, and governance, and how we prioritize. I don't want to say regardless of belief, but I want to say, well, you may or may not care about Hmong refugees, but it's the law, right? You have to disaggregate data. You have to have culturally tailored approaches. You have to fund this. And this is a play from tobacco control, right? We didn't just say, hey, smoking is bad for your health. You shouldn't do it. We actually increased the price of tobacco. We made it illegal to smoke indoors. And there's a strong public campaign to change social norms. And so the same kind of template, I think, applies to racial and health equity, is that, believe it or not, we're making sure that every bill that is being considered isn't just considered through a fiscal note, right? And that a fiscal note has to take into consideration an equity impact. So we're trying to embed racial and health equity into how bills are devised, assessed, how policies are made, even the structure of the legislature, creating an equity committee in the legislative process, or maybe an equity committee in your board of directors, right? Or even on your editorial board, Peter, right? Having an equity position, analysis, and not just a checklist, but it is a true praxis, right? In how you screen and how you assess your priorities. And so I wanna just give you the template in which we're trying to match structural solutions to a structural problem, instead of just trying to educate and throw a health fair approach to a structural problem.
So this is sort of, I don't mean to, but, you know, sort of putting a filter, a seat at the table, that this gets sort of baked into every process.
Yep.
So we get maybe begins with a mindset, but it sort of becomes part of the mechanics of how bills, how laws are made, how policies are executed.
That's so, right.
Can you give me maybe an example or two? Again, I don't know, in something that maybe Blue Cross Blue Shield did, or maybe something that you know, again, in this sort of,
sure,
we're in there, we're you know, you,
yeah, you so, know, so just a, so I just share kind of the high level template. Some examples, just yesterday, Peter, I testified in the House of Representatives in Minnesota on an equitable COVID vaccine distribution bill. And the heart of that bill was to create a COVID equity director's role and to have an equity leader on the vaccine distribution advisory team. So you'll notice that we just didn't want to translate a website into Spanish or Somali or Hmong, right? We wanted to have a position of power, of oversight, accountability into all key decision-making on the vaccine distribution. And so we went after the sources of power and decision-making, not just a component of vaccine distributions. Another example, I served in Minnesota what was called the Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council. And this council was created in statute. It wasn't created as a token gesture, right? Mm-hmm. It's state law to advise our Department of Human Services and equity policies. And this is a cross-cultural, cross-sector council. And we really function as the equity analysis and the equity impact for our largest state agency. And so by bringing in people with the lived experience, with the equity mindset and skill set that you alluded to, and it's not just about having a seat at the table, I would say it's actually about redesigning the tables, not filling vacancies into a system that is inherently flawed. And so I think what where the movement is going is we're trying to influence the way tables and key decisions are designed, not just being a component to be considered as an amenity. Yeah.
Now, has any of this played out in terms of health insurance or what Blue Cross Blue Shield does specifically?
Blue Cross has developed and passed its own equity policy to cover our contracting, our procurement, hiring, retention, the way we review policies and our own internal governance. This is fairly new, Peter, and I'll be honest, a lot of this has been outside in advocacy and making sure that Blue Cross takes an ecological approach to racial and health equity, not just inside our four walls and train our associates and educate and build into certain elements. We want to make sure it's enterprise wide, from how we design our business side to how to your communities, and that we're actually applying racial and health equity across that continuum of health, from the access treatment side. And we're not seeing housing or transportation or food security as, oh, it's so far upstream, it's irrelevant, you can't take on everything, Vajang, and you're gonna boil the ocean. And what we're trying to say is, like, actually, if you care about lowering healthcare costs, you actually do need to go upstream. Like, you're familiar with the concept of prevention. Why aren't you seeing prevention in the, why aren't you seeing racial and health inequities and structural racism in the name of prevention too? So I'll be the first one to admit, Peter, that Blue Cross of Minnesota is on its own journey and it has a lot of work to do. But there's a lot of conviction and there's a lot of humility there. And I'm nobody's pushing my organization harder than I am. And so I welcome your ongoing support and encouragement, not just from my organization, but for my industry, I would say. Our shared industry, really.
Yeah. And there is, of course, a lot of programmatic response in social determinants of health. Sort of the cliche, if you will, is the food pantry. There are some efforts to, housing first policies, of course.
Yep.
But whether that can just seem, as you were saying, that can just seem like, you know, we're adding a program here, a program there, and I'm not sure how fundamental it is. So I don't know how long have you been in this role?
Well, I've been at Blue Cross for 15 years now.
You're an old head at this point.
Yeah, that's like a third of my life. It's hard to believe. But I would say just about 5 years. Yeah.
So, of course, Minnesota became the center of discussions of race and institutional racism as a result of the death of George Floyd, coming up on the 1 year anniversary, the trial of the officer who was videotaped with his knee on Floyd's neck is started now. A jury has been picked. I'm wondering how you've processed what that has meant, either for your role of Blue Cross Blue Shield or where you live, or sort of just how it's changed things for you in this job, which, you know, you referenced the 2018 report and, you know, it's been there, but maybe now it feels entirely different. And what's changed for you?
You know, thanks for that question, Peter. This last year has been full of, I don't want to sound petty or bitter, but it's been full of angst, suffering, a bunch of I told you so's, right? For me, it is tragic, but it is no surprise that the murder of George Floyd happened here in Minnesota, and the murder of Philando Castile, right? Breonna Taylor, obviously not in Minnesota. But I just want to honor what has happened recently, but be very clear that this has been a pervasive pattern, and all the inequities that you see in COVID-19 and the murder of George Floyd are deeply connected. And I would say that, you know, without minimizing the importance to embed racial justice in our criminal system and in policing, but our community has been suffering slow deaths all along. We saw these gross preventable inequities again in cancer, diabetes, chronic disease. And Minnesota, if you looked at the data, Peter, our graduation rates, home ownership, you know, wealth, there are these gross inequities, and they don't cut neatly off at the border of certain sectors. So the conditions and the landscape of Minnesota has been brewing this condition for generations. And the murder of George Floyd it is a visible, visceral, disturbing indication of how inequitable our society is and how Minnesota is. And obviously Wisconsin, South Dakota, the United States has these issues, but there's something funky and disturbing about the inequities in Minnesota. And so, as a racial and health equity advocate, I'm joining forces, building solidarity across cultural communities, across sectors, to make sure that what we see kind of literally out in the streets has been happening before. And what happened in Atlanta last week, and the shootings and the anti-Asian racism in COVID, that we connect these immediate visceral violence happening in our streets to the visceral and preventable inequities happening in schools, in our homes, in our neighborhoods, that they all belong to this pattern. And so, your question strikes a chord with me, because I know Minnesota is the epicenter of racial inequities. And I think we have the onus and the opportunity to make sure that we are the epicenter of racial equity. And I just want to make sure, Peter, that when I say racial equity, true racial equity is intersectional, right? That it's applied to and joins forces with the LGBTQ community, with the disability community, with different incomes, with gender. And so we often say we lead explicitly, but not exclusively, on racial equity. And if you look at the data, racism is compounded across other communities that experience inequities too, whether that's sexism or homophobia, right? I want to make sure that we are not wedging communities against each other. That is actually a hope of white supremacy, honestly, that we are wedged against each other. And so I think where we are today in Minnesota is we're trying to honor that distinction and build solidarity across all communities that are experiencing racism and inequities.
So how you
hit a big trigger for me, so thank you.
You referenced I Told You So. So how did that feel personally? You referenced angst.
I don't know, Peter, if we sent you the polling information that really showed.
Yeah, the big split where 42% of Minnesotans didn't see racism as a problem, but if you interrogate the communities who are on the receiving end, it was more like 80%.
Yep. So yeah, you're right. 42% of white Minnesotans said racism is not a significant problem. 80% of Black, Latinx, Asian Pacific Islanders, and Indigenous said that it was. So that poll validates what those of us who wake up into racism every day know, that this has never been, again, a problem of data or information. It's been a problem of like, who cares and who matters, right? And there's the greatest inequity is in who is determining what matters. And that shows up in budgets, bills, policies, staffing plans, grants, right? And so that angst is not like this, like, oh, I have a chip on my shoulder. The angst is because my grandparents dealt with this, my parents. And I have a one-year-old and a five-year-old who I fear will have to deal with this too. And so that it is a intergenerational trauma. And angst is maybe not even the right word, because I don't want to make it sound like an emotional passing like feeling, right? It is something much more systemic and intergenerational. And so I just want to make sure that I highlighted that the polling confirms what our communities have known a long, long time. And that the inequities is in, again, in who is determining what matters, and then how do we subsequently fight for that and advocate for that.
As somebody who sort of thinks of maybe a little bit too much in images, but the notion that you are not only want a seat at the table, but want to change the shape of that table.
Yeah.
Is a strong image, and I think that maybe that's something to carry forward here and to keep in our brains. So we're just about out of time. I'm getting a little signal that the Zoom is going to give out on me. So I think we need to leave it there. You've given me, and I hope anybody who listens to this and watches it or reads what we'll create off the audio, something to think about. So, and maybe, and also act on. So thank you.
Thank you, Peter. And I know this topic is difficult to prompt, absorb, and take action on. So, but I think conversations like this can make sure it stays present and that we can create that healthy discomfort in our industry to take action. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening, and keep an eye out for the next episode of the MHE Talks Improving Patient Access podcast series. Episodes to this podcast can be found on our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.